And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents North America's Forgotten Past by W. Michael Gear and Kathleen O'Neill Gear. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Margie Tompros, Christopher Graybill, Gregory Gorton, Colleen Delaney, Alyssa Wilmoth, Danny Gavigan, Kimberly Gilbert, Julianne Elliott, Richard Rowan, Alexander Strain, Ken Jackson, Nick DePinto, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Michael Glenn, Casey Platt, Joseph Thornhill, Lily Beacon, Larissa Gallagher, James Konacek, Elizabeth Jernigan, Mort Shelby, Tim Carlin, Thomas Keegan, Yasmin Twazon, and Chris Rowan. Book 4, People of the River, Part 1.
Mac Jameson grumbled as he steered the John Deere tractor onto the dirt road that led through the center of his barley field. The warm breeze fanned the stalks until they waved like a blanket of gold. Illinois was mighty pretty at this time of year, but hot. Sweat had matted his faded red shirt and well-worn jeans to his arms and legs. At the age of 75, he still had a whip-thin body, though his muscles had mostly evaporated over the years. He wiped the back of a dusty hand over his sweating forehead to push the wisps of gray hair back from his deep-set brown eyes.
Bunch of goddamn government people called me up to talk about something they call a National Register of Historic Places District. That don't mean nothing to me. Does it mean something to you? You're the one who's always going out hunting arrowheads and pots.
Mac twisted around to peer at his son-in-law. Jimmy clung to the seat of the tractor as it bounced over the deeply rutted road. About 40, he had a face like a Pekingese, squashed and ugly, with a mop of red hair that hung over his ears. He cocked his head.
No, I ain't never heard of no National Register, but if it's historic sites they're after, they must be coming to see that mound you got at the southeastern corner of the farm.
What for?
Mac didn't have time for any government bullshit. The harvesters would be coming in tonight to start cutting his barley.
Who knows? Maybe some archaeologist wants to dig it up or something.
Dig it up? Why?
Jesus Christ, Pa! You live damn near on top of Cahokia Mounds, that's why.
What the hell is a Cahokia?
Pa! Cahokia is the biggest mound site in America. Maybe the world. They call it a World Heritage Site. I guess it probably is the biggest in the world. A hell of a lot of Indians lived there, maybe 1,000 years ago.
Indians? What do they got to do with this?
I don't know. But the tribes have been raising 7 kinds of hell in recent years. I heard they even forced a bunch of museums to give back some broken up bones because they said the bones was from their ancestors. Can you believe that? They fought for a bunch of bones.
Mac's eyes darted over the rolling swells of land while he mentally cataloged all of the graves that dotted this quarter section. Up on the rise stood two lonely crosses, tilted sideways now after 100 years of rain and wind, marking grandparents who had passed on from smallpox. And scattered irregularly along the edges of the fields lay tiny mounds of earth, the resting places of babies who had died for no good reason at all. Every year, Mac and his wife Marjorie went out and set the border stone straight again to prevent some field hand from running over them with his plow.
You think those government people want something out of that mound? I won't have no painted up buck on my land. Good white folks had enough trouble with them over fishing rights up north. Hell, the Indians think they own the whole world. Well, they don't own my farm. My family's been plowing this 160 acres for 200 years.
Oh, now don't get pissed off, Paul. Not yet. Them government people probably just want to ask you some questions. You know, stuff like what kind of arrowheads you've been pulling up under your desk, or if you've ever hit any human bones, or the like.
Mac's chest tightened. Every time he evened up the border at the base of that mound, he hit bones. He figured they were deer bones, but they might have been human. He didn't know how he'd know.
You know how it is, Pa. Some archaeologist probably got a bunch of taxpayer dollars and decided your mound might be important or something. Don't worry about it. This is America. If you want to tell them to go shit themselves blue, you can do it, because this is your land.
Mac nodded sternly, but as he fought the wheel to guide the tractor up the last hill, his guts started to roil.
What right do those government bureaucrats have to come and tell me what to do with my land? Well, Jimmy ain't right about much, but he's right about this being America. By God, there are laws against trespassing, and if I don't like what the bureaucrats have to say, I'll damn well throw them off my property.
By the time the tractor crested the hill, Mac had a knot in his stomach the size of that damned mound. They topped the crest, and the tractor launched down the other side toward the mound and the county road that skirted his farm. His eyes narrowed when he saw the state of Illinois Bronco sitting at the bottom next to what looked like a federal truck. He scowled at the lettering on the side.
What the hell? A federal truck? Department of the Interior. National Park Service. Aw, shit.
Tan dust billowed around the two as they climbed off the tractor. Mac tramped across the soft earth toward the Broncos, glaring out of the corners of his eyes at the mound that stood like a small mountain beside the road. Trees covered the top of the mound, their red, gold, and green leaves fluttering in the breeze. His family had been climbing that mound for years to have picnics. He'd watched his daughters roam the top in the springtime, gathering handfuls of flowers for their mother. Why, his own grandfather, Samuel Jenkins Jameson, had proposed to his grandmother Lily up under the spreading limbs of that tallest poplar. And yes, Mac had even buried a child up there, a girl of 20, killed in a damn car accident. Pain constricted around his old heart, and he wondered how that loss could still grieve him after 35 years. This mound represented his family history, not some damn Indians who lived 1,000 miles away. Mac rounded the nose of the state Bronco, his hair prickling, and stopped dead in his tracks when a blonde woman opened the door and jumped out. She carried a brown box under her arm.
Mr. Jameson? I'm Karen Steiger, archaeologist for the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. You spoke to my colleague, Rick Williams, on the phone?
She walked forward with a warm smile that set Mac back some. And she was a pretty little thing, which made it worse. 30, maybe. She wore a lavender and tan plaid shirt with jeans and hiking boots. A mass of blonde curls framed her oval face, highlighting her tanned complexion and turquoise-colored eyes.
Oh, God damn, Paul. Let me talk to this one. You take the Indian.
What Indian?
Mac saw the tall man coming around the side of the federal Bronco. Indian, all right. Tall and thin, but he had the moony red face of most of the tribes that loafed around these parts. He wore one of those off-green uniforms that federal employees loved as symbols of their authority. Steiger strode up with her hand extended.
Thank you, Mr. Jameson, for agreeing to come out and talk to us. This is Dr. Jonathan Cole, Chief Archaeologist for the Office of the National Register of Historic Places. It's part of the Park Service.
Mac shook Steiger's slender fingers and nodded in the most courteous manner he could manage, then silently shook the Indian's hand.
Mr. Jameson, thank you. You have a very important site here that we'd like to help you protect.
Help me? I always get real nervous when people from the government say that to me. So why don't you hurry it up and tell me what you want? I've got harvesters coming in at dusk. I'd appreciate it if you'd be taking up as little of my time as possible.
Yes, I'm sorry about the timing, Mr. Jameson. We know this is a busy month for farmers. Could you come over here, please?
She stepped out, the Indian at her side, and headed for the southern edge of Mac's mound. He'd have to be squaring that up again. He hadn't been out here for a while, and a half ton of dirt had sloughed off into a pile at the base. It must have happened recently, because the rich soil hadn't sprouted any grass yet. Steiger knelt by the pile and rummaged in it for a moment before she came up with a fragment of shell that gleamed like molten ivory in the afternoon sun. She rose and handed it to Mac. He turned the small object over and over in his hand, studying the beautiful designs that had been carved into it. Looked like some kind of stylized spider.
That's part of a gorget, Mr. Jameson. A necklace. The Mississippian people who lived here in the 12th and 13th centuries imported that shell all the way from the Gulf Coast so that they could engrave it and wear it as jewelry.
Mississippian? Is that Indian?
Yes, sir. Classic Mississippian culture flourished in the American Bottom area for approximately AD 900 to AD 1350. It was an extremely advanced culture with trade routes that spanned the country. We think...
Well, that's mighty fine, but what are you interested in my mound for?
Jimmy sneaked up behind him to eye the shell, and Mac noticed Steiger's brow lift in what he assumed to be a mixture of speculation and disdain. The Indian just looked on stoically. Jimmy grabbed the bit of shell to eyeball it carefully.
Let me see that, Pa.
We came to know about your mound, Mr. Jameson, when we caught a thief stealing artifacts from another site on state land. He had an entire array of looted arrow points, celts, pots, and other artifacts at the time we apprehended him. In the process of the investigation, he admitted to plundering a number of sites on private land in this vicinity. He pinpointed yours on a map.
Are you telling me that some son of a bitch came out here to dig up my mound without my permission? What? Well, that's robbery!
What was his name? The thief's name, what was it?
Franklin Jezebee. Why? Do you know him?
No, ma'am. I was just wondering. That was all.
Yes, Mr. Jameson, it was robbery. America is one of the few countries in the world where antiquities can belong to individuals. Usually, countries consider archaeological and historical sites to be national treasures, not private property to be destroyed or saved as the landowner sees fit. This mound does belong to you, and that's why we're here. We'd like to enlist your cooperation in protecting it.
What tribe are you? I bet you're Cherokee or something, ain't you?
No. My heritage is Natchez. That's one of the reasons I'm so interested in protecting sites like this one. The Natchez are probably the descendants of the Cahokians.
Probably? Archaeologists. They can't decide about nothing.
Mac shoved Jimmy away so he could get some breathing room before he turned back to the archaeologists.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand all this protection talk. You mean you'd punish people for digging up my land?
Among other things.
A 68 Chevy truck passed, its occupants waving. Mac waved back, not knowing who they were. But in these parts, people did that. Waved to you just because you were human. In the distance, a curl of smoke rose from one of the plants in St. Louis. Mac studied it briefly, watching the gray spiral across the expanse of blue sky. Damn pollution got worse every year. Pretty soon, there wouldn't be any farmland. And not just because farmers hung on the edge of starvation. All of the land would be taken up by industries and condominiums. He wondered what would happen to the mounds then.
Yes. If you allowed us to list your archaeological site as part of the National Register District that Dr. Thakol is proposing for this region, we could prosecute anyone who vandalized this site, and do it under both state and federal laws for the preservation of antiquities.
The Indian squared his shoulders and straightened up to his full height. He towered over Mac and Jimmy.
Mr. Jameson, we've selected a number of important mound sites that we would like to help protect. Right now, we're attempting to gain landowner permission to include the sites in our district nomination. That's the paperwork we have to fill out. We can't list your site without your permission, sir.
Wait a minute. What's my pa have to agree to if he goes for this nomination crap?
Steiger bristled at the last word. She fixed Jimmy with a look that would have liquefied metal. Max squelched his amusement when his son-in-law unconsciously took a step backward. That little woman might look frail, but Max suspected she could take on a grizzly and come out about even. Steiger extended her hand.
I don't think we've been introduced.
Jimmy shook her hand once and quickly withdrew, moving to stand halfway behind Mac.
I'm James Andrew Ortner. I work this farm with Mac.
Work? You mean you lay around on your fat ass while I work this farm? What do I have to agree to, Miss Steiger?
Just keep doing what your family has been doing for generations. Don't plow up the mound. Don't build on it. Don't disturb it in any way. Just leave it as it is. That's all you have to agree to, and there might be some tax breaks in it for you if you do. Congress is debating the issue, like they do every year.
Steiger and the Indians seemed to be waiting breathlessly for Mac's answer. He fingered the gray stubble on his chin while he watched a gust of wind sweep over the mound and through the trees. The sweet scent of ripe barley pervaded the air.
That's it?
Yes. Karen, can I have that box, please?
She took it from beneath her arm and handed it over. The Indian opened it gently and lifted out a beautiful black pot bearing spiral designs around the shoulder.
This is yours, Mr. Jameson. We confiscated it from the thief who robbed your mound. Please, let us help you protect this site.
Well, I don't know.
It sounded like they were offering to pay him through a cut in taxes for doing what his kin had been doing for centuries. And he knew for a fact that the government only took, it never gave. Some people might have accepted subsidies, but he never had. He knew that somewhere down the line, the conniving bureaucrats would figure out a way to get it back fourfold. That was just the way the government worked.
Why don't you send me all the information and I'll talk to my wife and kids about it? This land will be theirs one day, so they ought to have something to say in the decision.
Thank you for considering it seriously. We know you're busy, and we'll be going now. If you don't mind, could I call you next week?
Mac nodded as he shook the agent's hand.
I guess that'll be all right. Most of the crop should be in by then.
For an Indian, the coal seemed all right.
Thank you again, sir.
The Indian nodded with extreme politeness to Jimmy before he walked away, back to his Bronco. Steiger took Mac's hand in a strong grip, but her eyes went to Jimmy, sharp, alert.
Mr. Jameson, just so you'll know, Jezebi implicated a number of other people in his crimes. We've no evidence against them yet, but if we get any, we'll certainly inform you. We believe that you have a right to know the names of the people who have stolen your property and plundered part of the heritage of all Americans. We'll be in touch, Mr. Jameson. Good day to you.
Hey, wait a minute! What kind of pot is that, the one you gave my pa?
We call it Raimi incised ware.
Jimmy's mouth gaped, but he quickly closed it. Jimmy ripped the black pot from Mac's hands and stared at it, unblinking.
Good God almighty, pa. A Raimi pot? They made these special at Cahokia. Trading them all over, Kingdom Come, we can get $40,000 apiece for these in Japan. Holy Christ!
Jimmy rubbed a hand over his sunburned face. Sweat had matted red hair to his temples in greasy strands.
I can't believe it! You ain't never gonna have to face no more hard times on the farm, Pa. Why, next week, we'll bring the disc out and start taking that mound down inch by inch until we found every one of these. We could be millionaires!
But what about protecting our American heritage and all that?
Oh, come on, Pa! Don't you want to leave anything to your kids? This piece of sod ain't going to be worth nothing in 5 or 10 years, you know that? What's a heritage compared to a pretty dress for your daughter Janie? How about a college education for little Matthew, huh? Yeah, James Jr. could use a red Porsche, for God's sake, and he's almost 16. Come on, think.
Mac jerked the pot back.
Boy, when I need your advice, I'll ask for it. And I don't. Get back to the North 40 and wait for the harvesters to come in.
Jimmy stood there with his jaw clenched, staring at the pot like he was about to make a dive for it.
Get moving, goddammit! I'll fire you right now, boy, even if you are my daughter's husband.
Jimmy backed away, then spun and started stalking up the dirt road. But Mac could tell from the expression on his mad dog face that the boy's thoughts had gone rough. He watched Jimmy disappear over the crest of the hill.
Little son of a bitch. I'd have disinherited him just because.
He quietly ambled over to the pile of dirt where the thieves had been digging. Carefully, he made his way down into the hole they had carved out of the mound.
40,000. That's almost unbelievable. For an old Indian pot? Why would the Japanese care about old pots?
Laying the artifact aside, Mac sank down against the slope of the hole. He could see bits of shell and fragments of pot scattered everywhere in the back dirt pile. He let his hand sink into the rich soil that his family had damn near worked itself to death over during the long years when prices soared and then plummeted. Mostly plummeted. He gripped the dirt in a tight fist and brought it up.
My farm. Mine and Marjorie's.
Something poked out of the dirt, jabbing into his thumb. Max slowly uncurled his hand and squinted down at the tiny black wolf that gleamed in the sunlight. Made of polished stone, the shape had been smoothed over the centuries. It might have been a raven, but it looked more like a wolf. Then he glanced down at the place where he'd found the wolf, and his eyes narrowed. A rib marred the soil in a rounded arc. He rubbed his fingers over the area, revealing two more ribs and a skull with a round hole in one side. Perfectly round. As if the hole had been deliberately drilled for some kind of brain surgery. He looked again at the stone wolf, still in his hand. It would have been resting just about over the heart, like the pendant of a necklace.
Did you wear this, honey?
He didn't know why he thought the skeleton belonged to a woman. Maybe it was just the delicacy of the bones, and maybe it was because he knew that this mound held his own daughter's body. A tingle shot out of the wolf and played over his fingertips.
Damn.
Gently, he put the stone wolf back in place between those narrow bars of ribs, then brushed dirt over the skeleton, leaving her as she was before somebody tried to rob her grave.
Grave robbing.
He got to his feet, picked up the Raimi pot, and trudged up out of the hole, where he stood in the lengthening shadows cast by the trees on top of the mound. He let his eyes drift over the grassy contours of the slope, noting each bush and rock. Beautiful. It always had been. For as long as he could remember, that mound had provided the only shade for miles.
And Jimmy boy wants to disc you down, old gal. Well.
Mac tipped the Raimi pot sideways to get a good look at it. It almost glowed beneath the sun. He wondered how the Indians got it so black, if it had belonged to that dead woman. The robbers had taken it from pretty close to her grave. His faded eyes drifted to the top of the mound where his daughter lay. He tried to imagine how he would have felt if the thief had started digging at the top of the mound instead of at the bottom. Far back in his mind, he could hear Marjorie crying, just as she had cried on that terrible day 35 years ago when they had lain their Catherine Jean in that dark hole. Anger mixed with hatred, stinging his veins. He'd have found the bastard that dug up his girl's grave, and he'd have been carrying his old 30-30 when he did. He turned and glanced uncomfortably at the Indian woman's grave.
How do you get that hole in your head, honey? Didn't you have any folks to protect you? Where was your daddy when you needed him?
Mac patted the John Deere affectionately. He started lugging down the road for the house, the black pot snugged under his left arm. Jimmy could handle the harvesters. Mac wanted to go home. His old body suddenly felt too tired to work, and he knew that Marjorie would be waiting for him, waiting to welcome him home like she had for 52 years.
$40,000.
The memory of those delicate ribs had imprinted itself on his very soul.
Good Lord. That's 2 years worth of work on this old farm. Well, hell. Maybe we could just disc down part of that mound. Just enough to find two or three more of these pots.
Unseen presences moved through the village of Talontown, whirling in time to the beat of a pot drum, brushing ghostly shoulders with the human dancers whose fluid movements brought life to the forces of the stars, clouds, lightning. Longhorn had come, and the Mudheads. The War Brothers danced behind them, their invisible arms reaching for the sky. They'd climbed down out of the shining mountains to join humans in celebrating the spring corn dance and to watch the happenings on this critical day in the history of men. They spun to the lilt of the flute, their spectral feet pounding out the same cadence that had created the world. Plumes of dust rushed down the sheer flanks of the tawny sandstone cliffs, hurling themselves at the people gathered in the central plaza of the giant pueblo. A few of the elderly ran for doorways as the battering veil of crimson struck. But everyone else kept dancing, even the little children in their bright kirtles and doll moccasins. Fires sputtered, throwing the shadows of the dancers like amorphous monsters on the clay-washed faces of the buildings. Yarrow and Crane Girl trotted into the lee of a white-plastered wall to avoid the stinging bite of wind-blown sand. Only here, at the southern edge of the sprawling complex, could a person escape the brunt of the dust storm. Talontown spread in an enormous crescent moon around the central plaza, its five-story height throwing long shadows across the towering red cliffs at its back. A chunky vista of buttes and ridges stretched to the west and curved around the south like a lover's cradling arm. The vanished sun threw a pink haze over the jagged drainages that wound through the valley bottom. Yarrow and Crane Girl crouched down as best they could, given their child-heavy bellies. Yarrow threw her head back, sniffing at the odor of warm desert dust, mixed with the pungency of chamisa, greasewood, and sagebrush. Crane Girl squinted her slanting brown eyes against the wind-blown locks of short black hair that slapped her in the face, and drew her turkey feather cape over her head for protection.
Oh, look at my jade. She looks like she's been dancing for 20 summers. Perfect.
She's been practicing. She said she didn't want to look stupid this time.
Yarrow's 4 summers old daughter danced near the front of 2 serpentine lines composed of men, women, and children. Naked to the waist, Nightshade wore white moccasins, a red and green kirtle, and a yellow cap decorated with copper bells. A turquoise pendant bounced over her bare chest, while waist-length black hair whipped around her shoulders, tangling in the sprig of pine she carried in her left hand. Her right hand shook a gourd rattle. Yarrow could not hear her daughter, but she could tell that Nightshade sang with all her heart. Her little head rocked with the effort. Yarrow watched as the swirling wall of red raced through the sage in the distance. The 2 lines of dancers flared outward, turning, dividing, linking themselves into 4 slow-moving circles. Nightshade seemed confused by the action. Then her eyes widened as she raced around, shoving through the closest circle to join the correct one. Yarrow clamped a hand over her mouth in embarrassment.
Well, almost perfect. I hope my child works as hard at her age. Nightshade is always trying to fit in.
Yarrow's brows pinched together, but she tried to smile. Crane Girl didn't realize what she'd said, though her words affected Yarrow like a fist in the stomach.
Yes, Nightshade tries hard to fit in. Too hard. She's always been different. She never plays with other children. She's forever locked inside her own soul, talking to spirits no one else can see. My fault for having inherited the tortoise bundle.
Yarrow's mother and grandmother had been great shamans, but not she. She had inherited the bundle, as was her right as the eldest daughter, but she had never been able to coax life from it. It sat, quiet, dead, in her room, as if waiting for some cataclysmic event to free its power. Only Nightshade seemed to hear the bundle's voice. The little girl would stay up all night sometimes, listening to it, telling the bundle the childish secrets she ought to have been sharing with her mother. And Sunfather knew Yarrow could have used the companionship. Since Red Kane's death last autumn, she had been more lonely than she'd ever admitted. Losing her husband had gouged a wound inside her that had never stopped bleeding. Strangely, Nightshade seemed hardly aware that her father had vanished from her life. It worried Yarrow, but she couldn't bear to force her little girl to face that terrible truth, especially when Yarrow herself could scarcely face it. A layer of purple swelled over the ridges, pushing up the pink of dusk until Skyboy's darkening belly devoured it. A few stars already peeked through the blanket overhead. As night deepened, the tangy scents of pinyon pine and juniper grew stronger. Yarrow inhaled them, letting them soothe her aching body. She had been working day and night, making clothing, cooking food, seeing that all of the correct ceremonial admonitions were obeyed by her clan members. Yarrow belonged to the Hollow Hoof Clan. As keepers of the sacred tortoise bundle, they had to do everything just right to set an example for the rest of the community. The slightest dietary violation or an emotional outburst could cause the bundle to abandon the people. If that happened, the rains would stop and the land would blow away, taking the crops and people with it. Yarrow forced her thoughts back to the corn dance, not wanting to think about the bundle or its constant needs anymore. She had grown tired to the bones of taking care of it, smoking it every day in sweet grass, sprinkling it morning and evening with corn pollen, singing over it to keep it happy. Yarrow had to admit, shamefully, that had it not been for Nightshade's unflagging attention, she might have cheated on the ritual mandates. The dancers stopped and fanned out into a gigantic circle. They hooked their arms together and started kicking their legs out as they bobbed up and down. The excitement felt palpable on the warm night air. Hundreds of feet stamped and shook the earth with the force of Thunderbird's roar, preparing the world for the entry of the gods. Old people ducked through the doorways again, coming out to huddle together along the curve of the wall. In their pale shawls and snowy doe-hide boots, they looked ghostly.
Oh! It's almost time! Better get the bundle. I'll be right back.
Yarrow braced one hand against the wall and the other on her huge belly as she pushed to her feet. Awkwardly, she ran around the end of the building and ducked through the T-shaped doorway into near darkness. Only the starlight streaming through the high windows lit the passageway. She took the first left, ducking through another doorway to enter her room. The bundle sat in the eastern wall niche, its painted hide gleaming in the starlight that penetrated the window. Yarrow approached it reverently. When she picked up the bundle, a slight tingle prickled her fingers, but nothing more. She turned it over to admire her artistry. Red, yellow, blue, and white spirals alternated around the edge, imitating the designs on tortoise shells. In the middle, she had painted a red hand. An eye glared out of the palm, black, glistening as though alive.
Are you ready? It's time to renew the world.
She clutched the bundle to her breasts and made her way down the dim hall and out into the evening again. In the sky, dust-spawned halos encircled the flaming points of stars. Eerie light penetrated the haze, turning the firelit faces of the dancers from gold to a smoky crimson. Yarrow wet her lips and trotted back to sit beside Crane Girl. She snuggled down against the white plaster, waiting. Old Man Carrying Wood shuffled backward across the plaza, sprinkling the hard-packed soil with bright yellow cornmeal to sanctify the way. His gray hair hung like a cape down his blue-painted back. People surged forward to get a look at the spectral figures that glided up from the subterranean ceremonial chambers. Then the crowd rolled back before them in whispering waves, readying a path for the gods. Not even the wind breathed as the six figures floated into the plaza, their magnificent capes of blue and red parrot feathers swirling about them. The gods emerged into the flickering light of the fires. Swaying, dipping, taking shape, the gods coalesced into 20 hands-tall figures with no arms or legs. Their masks caught the light and held it captive in glistening turquoise eyes and twisted mouths of pounded copper. Buffalo horns curved up like supplicating hands. The Tlatsinas had been created in the beginning of the world, when the people were tramping along the sacred road of life, searching for the middle place. On the 49th day of their journey, they had been forced to cross a raging river. Some of the children slipped off their mothers' backs and tumbled into the water, where they changed into strange creatures before swimming down the river to the Lake of Whispering Waters and establishing a town beneath the surface. In answer to the prayers of their mothers, they promised to come back once a cycle to the world of humans and dance to bring fertility to the fields. Yarrow could not suppress a smile at the expression on Nightshade's face. Her daughter stood riveted in the middle of the plaza, alone, her young knees trembling as she stared up into those oddly deformed masks. Human, bird, and wolf. Then a strange thing happened. Nightshade turned slightly to peer out at the darkness that cloaked the towering cliffs. Her mouth opened, her jaw hanging soundlessly for a moment. People smiled and pointed as Nightshade threw down her pine sprig and gourd rattle and darted out of the plaza, running headlong for her mother. Many children reacted that way to the dancers, but it puzzled Yarrow. Nightshade had never before been frightened during a ceremonial. In fact, she usually seemed unnaturally calm. Yarrow rose to her feet just before Nightshade grabbed her frantically around the legs.
Mother, run! Run!
Shh, Nightshade. The dancers won't hurt you. They've come to help us to bring life to the...
No! Hurry! They've come for me! They're almost here, Mother! Please!
Yarrow stumbled beneath Nightshade's tugs and almost dropped the tortoise bundle.
Nightshade, stop this! You're embarrassing me! Come on, let's...
Movement stirred the sage at the edge of Yarrow's vision. She whirled and saw shadows careening through the brush beyond the plaza. The truth didn't register until the enemy warriors burst into the plaza, shooting arrows and swinging clubs. The crowd scrambled to get away. Yarrow fell back against the wall, dragging Nightshade with her. One enemy, a tall youth, swung his war club into the head of the lead dancer, knocking the sacred mask into the dirt. Then he brought his club down on the old man's head. Yarrow watched the Tlatsina fall to his knees, gaze pleadingly at the sky, and silently topple into a heap of red and green feathers. She stared at the mask lying in the dirt, and her soul cried out in anguish. Who could do such a thing? The warriors were cutting like wild dogs through the scattering crowd. Yarrow did not recognize their clan symbols or their hairstyles. Tattoos covered these gaudy demons, and copper spools gleamed from their stretched earlobes. They had shaved their heads, except for a bristly ridge that ran down the center, while their forelocks had been braided with shell beads. They wore long war shirts decorated with strange stones and the feathers of birds that didn't inhabit this part of the world. A warrior ran at Yarrow and Crane Girl, his war club raised. Crane Girl lurched to her feet, struggling against her bulk in an effort to run. The warrior gripped her arm and swung her around. When she remained standing after being hit, he turned the club and used the jagged chert points embedded in the side to slash her throat. Crane Girl staggered, clutching at the blood that spurted from her neck before she reeled and fell.
Crane Girl! Mother! Come on!
Nightshade clawed a gash into Yarrow's arm, and the stab of pain forced her mother into action. Yarrow grabbed Nightshade's hand and dashed away, trying to reach their doorway. They rounded the corner, their skirts flying around their legs, and ran headfirst into three of the hideous tattooed warriors. Yarrow backed up, her knees almost too weak to support her. She shoved Nightshade against the wall behind her, trying to protect her daughter.
Don't hurt us! Who are you? What do you want?
The warriors spread out into a semicircle. The leader stepped forward, fear and desperation in his black eyes. He was a big man, young, with a squat toad face and the burly body of Grandfather Brown Bear. The blue spiders tattooed on his cheeks twitched as if alive. He eyed the tortoise bundle fearfully, then scrutinized Nightshade's tiny face as she peered from behind the folds of Yarrow's skirt. He gestured with a spike-studded club, and the short warrior on the left, a man tattooed with frightening forked eyes, swallowed convulsively. The pale shell gorget on the man's breast jerked with the effort. Then the warrior on the right pointed at the designs on the tortoise bundle, nodding as though he recognized those colorful decorations and what the bundle meant to Yarrow's people. The muscular leader tensed. His glittering eyes slitted as he studied the bundle. Then he nodded. The short warrior lunged for the bundle, tearing it out of Yarrow's hands, before the muscular leader shoved her away to get to Nightshade.
No!
He slung the squirming little girl under a massive arm as Yarrow stumbled to regain her balance. Yarrow barely noticed the third warrior draw his bow, the chert point oddly luminescent.
Leave her alone! Let my baby go! Let her go!
She did not even feel the arrow that pierced her breast clean through, but the force of the impact sent her pitching sideways, and she struck the wall hard. She had to dig her fingernails into the mortar to keep from falling. The baby filling her belly kicked and kicked again. Panic held her for a few seconds, then faded into a curious sensation of acceptance. A gray haze swam around the edges of her vision, sapping her strength. She caressed the bright feathers protruding from the shaft buried in her chest as she slumped slowly down the wall. Her feet had become tangled painfully under her, and she couldn't move them. She sat, stunned.
Mother! Mother, mother! Help me!
Yarrow looked up to see her daughter's wide black eyes disappearing into the starlit darkness of the desert. And something else. Something that made Yarrow shake her head weakly to try to clear her eyes. A huge figure pranced after Nightshade, half transparent in Yarrow's wavering sight. It towered over the enemy warriors. Pivoting on one foot, the creature spun low to the ground, like weasel chasing his tail, and Yarrow saw its massive, twisted face, colored with the pink clay of the sacred lake.
One of the dancers? No. No. A mudhead.
He danced suspended between earth and sky, the undulant swaying of his arms sweeping clouds in and out of existence, parting the veil between life and death, light and dark. Yarrow's body went completely numb, unfeeling. She sagged forward and sprawled over the cool ground. Since she could no longer blink her eyes, the wind-blown sand glued itself to the orbs. But through the gritty film, she could still see the mudhead. He smiled grotesquely at her, sealing a bargain. Lycan, daughter of the Morningstar clan, ran along the ridgetop, dodging the bristly arms of dogwood and beaver root until she found the trail that skirted the edge of the cornfield. The faded leaves of last cycle's crop snatched at her dress as she jumped a deep gully and angled down the incline, heading for the tan humps of limestone in the distance. She glanced over her shoulder to make sure that her friend Flycatcher could jump the gully. Flycatcher was a summer younger than she, barely nine, and he had the shortest legs she had ever seen on a boy. He took a flying leap and made it, but stumbled on the other side and fell to his knees. Dust plumed up around him.
That was a deep one, wasn't it?
Who cares about deep? It was as wide as the father water.
He brushed the dirt from his bare legs and straightened the blue headband that kept his shoulder-length black hair out of his eyes. He had a round face and a small, forever wiggling nose. Flycatcher liked to smell things, some of them pretty putrid, Lycan thought. Once last spring, he had taken her to a recently abandoned bear den to prove to her that he could distinguish the cubs' sleeping places from the sows just by the smell of the urine. As Flycatcher trotted toward her, Lycan turned and sprinted on down the trail. She passed the far boundary of the cornfield and descended the slope through a garden of boulders. The irregular surface bit at her moccasined feet. The trail had been worn into the stone here and was polished smooth by thousands of feet. but Wind Mother blew enough sand and gravel into the trough to make the going miserable until the traveler climbed up the next hill, where the rain swept the trail clean. Lycan moved along as fast as she could. When she crested the slope, the beauty of First Woman's Land lay spread around her, vast and carved into odd shapes by the ice giants who had once roamed this swampy river country. In the rich bottomlands below, water rushed down dozens of creeks and flowed into a strewn handful of ponds and lakes. Women sat on the shores washing clothes. Men labored farther north, felling the scraggly trees that grew along the bluffs. The trees would be taken back to the mound construction sites in the great village of Cahokia. Everyone else had stopped building mounds long before Lycan had been born. Only the Sun Chief still worked to lift Mother Earth so she could touch fingertips with Father Sun. Across the Father Water, to the west, tan and gray bluffs thrust their blunt noses into the turquoise sky. Lycan had never been there, but she knew that Pretty Mounds sat on the highest bluff. She had a cousin of the Grasshopper clan who always came from Pretty Mounds to visit during the green corn ceremonial. To the south, the direction in which Lycan and Flycatcher ran, a bank of blue-black clouds trailed filaments of rain over gnarled limestone spires.
How much farther?
Not much.
Lycan pointed ahead. The irregular line of the bluff climbed to the tallest spire, which thrust out over the sheer cliffs like a long snout. On the ledge beneath it, a thick copse of bare-branched oaks hid Wanderer's rock shelter.
Wanderer's house is in the side of the cliff, just past those oaks.
Lycan, are you sure we should go see him? My mother says he's a crazy old witch.
I have to talk to him, Flycatcher. He's the only one who understands about my dreams.
But my mother says the village elders banished him from living with humans because he has the soul of a raven.
He does, at least for the moment. He says his soul had many shapes before it became a raven. You'll like him. He tells great stories.
Lycan paused and looked back at Flycatcher. He stood awkwardly at the bottom of the slope, the flap of his tan breech clout waving in the breeze that swept the bluff top. A morose expression contorted his face.
What's wrong?
Flycatcher gazed up speculatively from beneath long lashes.
Flycatcher? He's not as crazy as people say. Wanderer is just different, but he's not bad. Come on, you'll see.
She waved him forward, but he stood as though rooted to the tan limestone.
But what if Wanderer does something to us? Like, cast a spell on us?
A spell? What for?
I don't know. Maybe he'd witch us to make us lose our human souls so he can put raven souls in our bodies.
Lycan spread her arms and whirled on her toes, imitating the soaring flight of a bird. A sense of freedom possessed her as she spun, her tan dress fluttering around her skinny legs.
I've always wanted to fly, Flycatcher. Haven't you?
No!
Lycan put her hands on her hips and shook her head. The curtain of rain had drawn closer, blotting out the sun as it came. She felt the first drops, cool and wonderful, on her face.
Then go home. I'll go by myself, just like always. But I'm telling you the truth. Wanderer's no witch, and he's not crazy either. Mostly.
Oh! Flycatcher leapt 2 feet off the ground. His mouth dropped open as the roar rolled over the rocky prominences and down the flanks of the limestone into the bottomland below.
See? Even Thunderbird agrees with me. You're a coward, Flycatcher.
Lycan turned and raced for Wanderer's rock shelter. Rain began falling in earnest, drenching her dress and the long black braid that bounced against her back. She tipped her pretty heart-shaped face so she could offer a silent prayer to Thunderbird, thanking him for the storm, praying he would bring more rain during the summer. The past few cycles had been so dry that the land desperately needed it, as did the animals and her people. Thunderbird's voice drove away the final chill of Frostman and awakened First Woman so she could begin to tend the land. Soon the shaggy coats of the few deer left near the bluffs would turn glossy. Fawns would be born. and Lycan's people would throw off the bitter faces of winter and smile.
Wait! Wait for me, Lycan! I'm coming!
She slowed her pace, but kept walking purposefully. She could see the outline of Wanderer's rock shelter, hidden in the tangle of branches ahead. The hair on the nape of her neck had started to prickle. Power did that. It rode the wind like tiny teeth until it could find a human and eat its way inside to coil around the soul. That had happened to Lycan long ago. She had been just 4 summers when the first spirit had walked in her dreams. It had crept like tendrils of blue light from the tiny stone wolf that Lycan's mother guarded, and had coalesced into a majestic birdman with an eagle's head and wings, but the skin of a snake. The creature had knelt by the side of her bed and gazed at her through gleaming black eyes.
Do you know why owls die with their wings outspread, little one?
She had shaken her head, too afraid to speak. She remembered trying to crawl deeper into the mound of worn hides covering her. Birdman had gently touched her cheek with a snakeskin hand.
Because they try to fly until the very last. They never give up and close their wings. They know that flight is their only hope of survival. In the beginning of the world, when Earthmaker formed the clay into mountains and deserts, humans used to have wings, like mine. It was in the time when animals and men lived together. A person could become an animal if he wanted to, and an animal could become a human. Would you like that, Lycan?
Yes.
The world needs you. There's a terrible war coming. First Woman has grown angry with humans. She wants to abandon the world and let all of you die. You will be able to save the world only if you can grow wings and fly to her cave in the underworld to talk to her. To do that, you must learn to view life through the eyes of a bird, a human, and a snake. It's very difficult. The worst part is that once you open your wings, you will never be able to close them again. Just like Owl.
Would that be bad?
Birdman had smiled sadly and bowed his head, staring at Lycan's bare toes, which had poked out from beneath her hides. Moonlight streaming in the window over her bed glinted off her toenails.
Sometimes, Lycan, an owl longs with all its heart to be a snake, so it can crawl into a hole and hide in the darkness.
Do I have to learn to fly now?
No. Soon. You'll know when.
Then Birdman had risen, opened his wings, and soared out her window into the starry night sky, going higher and higher until she lost sight of him. Lycan still did not understand what he had been trying to tell her, but she had never forgotten his words. Her mother had explained that spirits often spoke in riddles, and that one day, when Lycan was older, she would understand Birdman's message. Flycatcher rushed up and nearly bumped into her. He looked like he'd fallen again. Rain washed the bloody scratches that marred his elbows and the narrow gash that zigzagged down his right arm.
Did you hurt yourself?
Your legs are too long, and I wish you'd act like a girl.
What does a girl act like?
How should I know?
Lycan shrugged and took him by the hand, confidently leading him toward the oaks beneath the spire. The trail split, one path leading up over the bluff top and across the overhang, the other angling down through the trees and onto the ledge, where Wanderer's house sat, tucked into the hollow in the cliff face. They had to step carefully over the slick limestone as they made their way to the copse of oak.
Wanderer? It's Lycan. I've brought Flycatcher with me. Are you here?
Wanderer had built his house in the dry, scooped-out area beneath the overhang, so that he had needed to cut logs for only 2 sides. He had covered the upright poles with a thick mat of tan clay, which kept the house invisible unless one knew where to look. A tiny doorway and one window graced the front. Lycan pushed through the branches and trotted for the dry ground, glancing briefly at the briar of chokecherry bushes that fringed the rim of the ledge. Flycatcher scampered at her heels, looking like a frightened rabbit that had just escaped a flooded burrow. Wet straggles of black hair framed his face.
Well, is he? Is he here?
I don't think so.
Lycan peered through the low doorway. Wanderer's house always smelled odd. The scent of cedar smoke, rich earth, and spirit potions hung in the air. The room was a small, irregular rectangle, 20 hands by about 15. Because Wanderer had plastered the inside with white clay, it seemed to glow even in the dim light of the cloudy day. Covering the walls were power symbols, green squares and red spirals, black crescent moons and purple starbursts. The old man's woven rabbit fur blankets lay in a tumbled heap in the northern corner. All along the back wall, brightly colored baskets of coughgrass root, dried cactus blossoms, fish scales, snake heads, and other things that Lycan couldn't remember made bulges in the shadows. But Wanderer was gone. Lycan slumped down on the cattail mat that lay before the door.
Oh, great mouse! What am I going to do now? I need to talk to Wanderer.
Flycatcher eased down beside her, his brown eyes wide and wary. He propped his elbows on his drawn-up knees, and Lycan could see that blood still oozed from the scrape on his right arm. She decided not to say anything about it because she didn't want to embarrass him. Flycatcher got teased enough by his friends over his height and his awkwardness.
What's that strange smell? Wanderer probably made another potion for his aching joints. He tries new ones all the time. Nothing seems to help, though. I think he's just getting old.
How old is he?
I don't know. Maybe 50 summers.
What's he like?
He's a good man. He loves everything, and he's smart. I helped him fix a robin's broken leg last spring. We tied twigs around it to keep it straight. Then Wanderer built a cage and caught worms and insects for the robin to eat.
He fixed its leg instead of eating it? He doesn't sound very smart to me. Roasted robin tastes great. So what was this dream you had that you have to talk to Wanderer about? Why couldn't you just tell your mother? She's the keeper of the stone wolf. She's supposed to understand spirit things.
She does.
Lycan laced and unlaced her fingers uncomfortably. Her mother didn't have Wanderer's knowledge of other places and people, or his power. But Lycan couldn't explain that to Flycatcher, because he would think she meant something bad about her mother, and she didn't, not really. Her mother had actually studied with Wanderer for a while, so she had to know some important things about dreaming.
But I've missed talking to Wanderer, Flycatcher. He's my friend. I haven't been here in about 3 moons, and I...
A flock of ravens swooped out of the clouds and dove for the cliff face. Flycatcher grabbed Lycan's arm in a death grip. The birds pulled up just before the shelter and floated on the air currents as they eyed the two children.
Who are they? Part of Wanderer's family?
If they are, I've never met them here before.
Sand trickled over the ledge. Lycan and Flycatcher craned their necks to look.
What is it? A cougar?
A shaft of sunlight pierced the clouds, lancing the rock shelter.
I don't...
There it is!
Flycatcher and Lycan crashed into each other, lunging to their feet, shoving and pushing, frantic to get away. But before they had taken 3 paces, Wanderer's tall, lanky form dropped from the overhang and landed like a thrown rock. Dust encircled him as he staggered sideways, his scant gray hair spiking out in wild disarray. Wanderer began grabbing up rocks and smashing them into the side of his house.
Look at it! Hurry! Get some rocks! We have to kill it! It pounced on me first thing this morning, tried to eat my feet!
Lycan's body jerked with each impact of stone against wall. Flycatcher had clutched her shoulders and hidden himself behind her. They stared in utter terror at the house, against which the long, dark shadow wavered in the sunlight.
Wanderer! That's your own shadow! Look how it moves when you do!
The old man stopped throwing in mid-swing. His rock-filled hand hovered over his head. He bent forward cautiously and squinted his faded brown eyes at the suspect darkness.
Oh, I wish you'd come earlier, Lycan. I wouldn't have wasted all day following it over the bluffs.
He strode forward in a tattered swirl of heavily painted wolfhide robe and lifted her off her feet to hug her.
In fact, I wish you'd come moons ago. I've done some very strange things this winter. I think I'm changing form again.
Lycan pried herself loose from his grip.
Wander, we'll talk about it later, all right? I want you to meet my friend.
She turned and extended her hand to Flycatcher, who had flattened himself against the side of the house and was panting as though he had just finished a tough race. Wanderer cocked his head and blinked at the boy like a demented owl.
Why, it's Flycatcher, isn't it? From the Serpent Clan. I remember the night you were born. What a nasty windstorm that was. It actually blew boulders off the ridgetops and sent them crashing down on people below. Yes, I recall that well. Of course, I wasn't much help with the cleanup. I had the soul of a vulture at the time, and I was...
Wanderer! Why don't we have some tea? I need to talk to you. I had a bad dream.
Oh, of course. You've come such a long way. You must have risen before dawn to get here so early. Please, go inside.
He knelt and gestured to his door. Lycan winked encouragingly at Flycatcher before she dropped to her knees and crawled into the cool, odd-smelling womb of the house. She went to the southern wall and sat cross-legged on a soft pile of foxhides.
Come on, Flycatcher, you little snake. I've got baskets full of your dead kin in there for you to look at. Hurry it up. Do I have to cast a spell on you to get you into my house?
Flycatcher dove through the doorway in a flying whirl of arms and legs. He scrambled up beside Lycan.
Not crazy, huh?
Wanderer ducked through the entry and smiled in that lopsided way of his.
My, it's good to have someone come to see me again. It's been such a long winter. How's your mother, Lycan? Did she ever go on the vision quest you mentioned last fall? As I recall, she was still struggling to tap the power in that stone wolf of hers.
Yes. I guess the vision quest worked a little. She says that sometimes after she's fasted and prayed for 6 days, she can feel the feathery touch of harmony coming from the wolf.
Well, she's making progress then, though she has a long way to go to reach the land of the ancestors in the underworld. I wish her well. And how about you? You had a bad dream? A spirit dream?
A single raven, a huge bird with a gnarled beak, fluttered down to sit on the windowsill. It peered suspiciously at Flycatcher and Lycan.
Ow!
Flycatcher sank his fingernails into Lycan's arm, and she wrenched herself away in self-defense. Red crescents marred her smooth skin.
Why, thank you, Crossbeak. No, I didn't know that.
Lycan peered at the bird from the corner of her eye as she watched Wanderer move about. Because of the low ceiling, he had to stand in a hunched position while he gathered the makings for a fire.
Yes, a spirit dream.
Wanderer's rumpled shadow swept the room as he arranged the twigs and kindling in the stone-lined hearth in the middle of the floor and used his fire bow to get a small blaze going. Flickers of light pranced across his long, beaky face. Then he propped two stumpware supports on the outskirts of the flames and braced his pot on top of them. After that, he wilted onto his tumbled blankets.
Well, let's hear about it while we wait for the water to heat up. The dream must have been frightening to drive you to me again.